The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction, written by David Timpson, read by Neville Jason. Sketches by Boz. In 1832, Charles Dickens was earning his living writing up the daily parliamentary reports for the monthly magazine, a tedious job with not much scope for writing fiction, except when he had to guess what an MP was saying, as the acoustics in the House of Commons were poor. The urge to be a creative writer had always been strong within him. One of his fellow pupils at school with him remembered, "He and I used to write short tales on scraps of paper, pin them together so as to form books with a few leaves, and lend them to other boys to read, for the small charge of a slate pencil, etc." At some point, though, in 1833, he began to write fiction in earnest. His first stories appeared in the monthly magazine in 1834. "My first effusion," he wrote, "dropped stealthily one evening at twilight, with fear and trembling, into a dark letterbox in a dark office up a dark corner in Fleet Street, appeared in all the glory of print." Uncertain as to his talents, he burst into tears on seeing his words in print for the first time. Before long, however, he was writing for several journals, and in 1836 he collected these first writings together and published them as Sketches by Boz. The pen name Boz derived from Dickens's way of saying Moses as a child through his nose, and it became a nickname in the Dickens family, not for Charles, but for his youngest brother, Augustus. In his Sketches, Dickens introduces us to his London, as he sees and experiences it. We follow Dickens the narrator through the highways and byways of London in search of edification, but much more importantly, amusement. His first pieces are descriptive of scenes of daily life, the bustle of London streets early and late, the very streets Dickens walked at all hours of the day and night throughout his working life, which provided him with his inspiration. When he was abroad, he never found the same stimulation in the streets of Paris or Genoa. The most striking aspect is the numerous activities that actually go on in the streets, lost sights for the most part, of muffin boys, 9 o'clock beer men, hot potato sellers, kidney pie men, and household servants. In Meditations in Monmouth Street, Dickens begins to give his creative powers scope as he imagines suits of second-hand clothes and old shoes coming to life. His description of the streets is like a snapshot image of London in the 1830s that would rapidly change even in Dickens's own lifetime as the metropolis expanded. The period of Sketches by Boz coincided with the beginnings of the railway, which gave working people the opportunity to move away from the centre of London into the fast-developing suburbs of Kilburn, Hampstead, Clapham, etc. In London Recreations, Dickens looks at how the growing population relaxes in its leisure hours, which were precious and few and far between in early 19th century Britain. Dickens's descriptions of the suburban working man taking pleasure in his garden is still today very much part of a Londoner's relaxation after a hard day's work. The Sunday trip out with the family into the local countryside, too, is still often a part of a London family's weekend. The rural tea gardens of Dickens's day were pale imitations of the old pleasure gardens of the previous century, like Vauxhall, but proliferated wherever the sprawling boundaries of London met the country. A special treat was the annual trip at Easter to Greenwich Fair, the bustle of which Dickens captures to perfection in his sketch. The early sketches are mainly descriptive, but it was not long before comic characters and plots began to appear in his sketches, anticipating the novels that were to come. In The Boarding House, one of his first fictions, he shows in its construction his passion for the theatre, and particularly the one-act farces that were so popular in the early 19th century. The boarding house could easily be transferred to the stage. With The Tugs at Ramsgate, Dickens gets into his stride as an author, and we begin to recognise traits that he developed in his later novels. The characterisation is more developed, and the humour less farcical. There is also early social comment, for the Tuggses are snobs, and seek pleasure merely to further themselves socially. On their ill-fated trip to Ramsgate, they deservedly come a cropper. The idea of a family seaside holiday was relatively new in 1836, only made possible with the advent of trains and steamers. But lest the public should think him a frivolous writer, Dickens is at pains to introduce more serious, even tragic, themes, and some of the sketches, like The Pawnbroker's Shop, prepare us in their somberness for his novels dealing with deprivation and social injustice. However, the sketches mainly show how important Dickens thought laughter and cheerfulness were to people's lives, and that their value should not be underrated or excluded. Hence his mockery of that old curmudgeon Nicodemus Dumps in the Bloomsbury christening, who actively seeks to put down good, wholesome fun. Dickens in later life rather disparaged these youthful excursions into print, but what dominates them is his love of London. It was a lifelong romance. The characters and stories grow out of their environment, the London streets, the London traditions, the poverty and pretentiousness that existed side by side, and which Dickens could make either comic or tragic, as he chose.
The Streets, Morning. The appearance presented by the streets of London an hour before sunrise, on a summer's morning, is most striking, even to the few whose unfortunate pursuits of pleasure, or scarcely less unfortunate pursuits of business, cause them to be well acquainted with the scene. There is an air of cold, solitary desolation about the noiseless streets, which we are accustomed to see thronged at other times by a busy, eager crowd, and over the quiet, closely shut buildings, which throughout the day are swarming with life and bustle, that is very impressive. The last drunken man who shall find his way home before sunlight has just staggered heavily along, roaring out the burden of the drinking song of the previous night. The last houseless vagrant, whom penury and police have left in the streets, has coiled up his chilly limbs in some paved corner to dream of food and warmth. The drunken, the dissipated, and the wretched have disappeared. The more sober and orderly part of the population have not yet awakened to the labours of the day. And the stillness of death is over the streets. Its very hue seems to be imparted to them, cold and lifeless as they look in the grey, sombre light of daybreak. The coach stands in the larger thoroughfares are deserted, the night houses are closed, and the chosen promenades of profligate misery are empty. An occasional policeman may alone be seen at the street corners, listlessly gazing on the deserted prospect before him. And now and then a rakish-looking cat runs stealthily across the road and descends his own area with as much caution and slyness, bounding first on the water butt, then on the dust-hole, and then alighting on the flagstones, as if he were conscious that his character depended on his gallantry of the preceding night, escaping public observation. A partially opened bedroom window here and there bespeaks the heat of the weather, and the uneasy slumbers of its occupant. And the dim, scanty flicker of the rushlight through the window-blind denotes the chamber of watching or sickness. With these few exceptions, the streets present no signs of life, nor the houses of habitation. An hour wears away. The spires of the churches and roofs of the principal buildings are faintly tinged with the light of the rising sun, and the streets, by almost imperceptible degrees, begin to resume their bustle and animation. Market carts roll slowly along, the sleepy wagoner impatiently urging on his tired horses, or vainly endeavouring to awaken the boy, who, luxuriously stretched on the top of the fruit baskets, forgets in happy oblivion his long-cherished curiosity to behold the wonders of London. Rough, sleepy-looking animals of strange appearance, something between ostlers and hackney coachmen, begin to take down the shutters of early public houses, and little deal tables with the ordinary preparations for a street breakfast make their appearance at the customary stations. Numbers of men and women, principally the latter, carrying upon their heads heavy baskets of fruit, toil down the park side of Piccadilly on their way to Covent Garden, and following each other in rapid succession, form a long, straggling line from thence to the turn of the road at Knightsbridge. Here and there a bricklayer's labourer, with the day's dinner tied up in a handkerchief, walks briskly to his work, and occasionally a little knot of three or four schoolboys on a stolen bathing expedition rattle merrily over the pavement, their boisterous mirth contrasting forcibly with the demeanour of the little sweep, who, having knocked and rung till his arm aches, and being interdicted by a merciful legislature from endangering his lungs by calling out, sits patiently down on the doorstep until the housemaid may happen to awake. Covent Garden Market, and the avenues leading to it, are thronged with carts of all sorts, sizes, and descriptions, from the heavy lumbering wagon with its four stout horses to the jingling costermonger's cart with its consumptive donkey. The pavement is already strewed with decayed cabbage leaves, broken hay bands, and all the indescribable litter of a vegetable market. Men are shouting, carts backing, horses neighing, boys fighting, basket women talking, pie men expatiating on the excellence of their pastry, and donkeys braying. These and a hundred other sounds form a compound discordant enough to a Londoner's ears, and remarkably disagreeable to those of country gentlemen who are sleeping at the hummums for the first time. Another hour passes away, and the day begins in good earnest. The servant of all work, who, under the plea of sleeping very soundly, has utterly disregarded Missus's ringing for half an hour previously, is warned by Master, whom Missus has sent up in his drapery to the landing-place for that purpose, that it's 6:30, whereupon she awakes all of a sudden with well-feigned astonishment, and goes downstairs very sulkily wishing, while she strikes a light, that the principle of spontaneous combustion would extend itself to coals and kitchen range. The Boarding House. Mrs. Tibbs was somewhat short of stature, and Mr. Tibbs was by no means a large man. He had, moreover, very short legs, but by way of indemnification his face was peculiarly long. He was to his wife what the nought is in 90. He was of some importance with her, he was nothing without her. Mrs. Tibbs was always talking. Mr. Tibbs rarely spoke, but if it were at any time possible to put in a word when he should have said nothing at all, he had that talent. Mrs. Tibbs detested long stories, and Mr. Tibbs had one, the conclusion of which had never been heard by his most intimate friends. It always began,
"I recollect when I was in the Volunteer Corps in 1806.
But as he spoke very slowly and softly, and his better half very quickly and loudly, he rarely got beyond the introductory sentence. He was a melancholy specimen of the storyteller. He was the Wandering Jew of Joe Millerism. Mr. Tibbs enjoyed a small independence from the pension list, about £43, 15 shillings and 10 pence a year. His father, mother, and five interesting scions from the same stock drew a like sum from the revenue of a grateful country, though for what particular service was never known. But as this said independence was not quite sufficient to furnish two people with all the luxuries of this life, it had occurred to the busy little spouse of Tibbs that the best thing she could do with a legacy of £700 would be to take and furnish a tolerable house somewhere in that partially explored tract of country which lies between the British Museum and a remote village called Somerstown for the reception of boarders. Great Coram Street was the spot pitched upon. The house had been furnished accordingly, two female servants and a boy engaged, and an advertisement inserted in the morning papers informing the public that six individuals would meet with all the comforts of a cheerful musical home in a select private family, residing within 10 minutes' walk of everywhere. answers out of number were received, with all sorts of initials. All the letters of the alphabet seemed to be seized with a sudden wish to go out boarding and lodging. Voluminous was the correspondence between Mrs. Tibbs and the applicants, and most profound was the secrecy observed. E didn't like this. I couldn't think of putting up with that. I.O.U. didn't think the terms would suit him. And G.R. had never slept in a French bed. The result, however, was that three gentlemen became inmates of Mrs. Tibbs's house, on terms which were agreeable to all parties. In went the advertisement again, and a lady with her two daughters proposed to increase, not their families, but Mrs. Tibbs's. "Charming woman, that Mrs. Mapleson," said Mrs. Tibbs, as she and her spouse were sitting by the fire after breakfast, the gentlemen having gone out on their several avocations. "Charming woman indeed," repeated little Mrs. Tibbs, more by way of soliloquy than anything else, for she never thought of consulting her husband. "And the two daughters are delightful. We must have some fish today. They'll join us at dinner for the first time." Mr. Tibbs placed the poker at right angles with the fire shovel, and essayed to speak, but recollected he had nothing to say. "The young ladies," continued Mrs. T., "have kindly volunteered to bring their own piano." Tibbs thought of the volunteer story, but did not venture it. A bright thought struck him. "It's very likely," said he. "Pray don't lean your head against the paper," interrupted Mrs. Tibbs, "and don't put your feet on the steel fender. That's worse." Tibbs took his head from the paper and his feet from the fender and proceeded. "It's very likely one of the young ladies may set her cap at young Mr. Simpson. And, you know, a marriage." "A what?" shrieked Mrs. Tibbs. Tibbs modestly repeated his former suggestion. "I beg you won't mention such a thing," said Mrs. T. "A marriage, indeed, to rob me of my boarders? No, not for the world!" Tibbs thought in his own mind that the event was by no means unlikely, but, as he never argued with his wife, he put a stop to the dialogue by observing it was time to go to business. He always went out at 10 o'clock in the morning and returned at 5 in the afternoon, with an exceedingly dirty face and smelling mouldy. Nobody knew what he was or where he went, but Mrs. Tibbs used to say with an air of great importance that he was engaged in the city. The Tuggses at Ramsgate. The sun was shining brightly. The sea, dancing to its own music, rolled merrily in. Crowds of people promenaded to and fro. Young ladies tittered, old ladies talked, nursemaids displayed their charms to the greatest possible advantage, and their little charges ran up and down and to and fro and in and out under the feet and between the legs of the assembled concourse in the most playful and exhilarating manner. There were old gentlemen trying to make out objects through long telescopes, and young ones making objects of themselves in open shirt collars. Ladies carrying about portable chairs, and portable chairs carrying about invalids. Parties waiting on the pier for parties who had come by the steamboat, and nothing was to be heard but talking, laughing, welcoming, and merriment. "Fly, sir!" exclaimed a chorus of 14 men and 6 boys the moment Mr. Joseph Tuggs, at the head of his little party, set foot in the street. "Here's the gentleman at last," said one, touching his hat with mock politeness. "Very glad to see you, sir. Been a-waiting for you these 6 weeks. Jump in, if you please, sir." "Nice little fly and a fast trotter, sir," said another. 14 mile an hour and surrounding objects rendered invisible by extreme velocity." "Large fly for your luggage, sir," cried a third. "Wery large fly here, sir. Regular blue bottle." "Here's your fly, sir," shouted another aspiring charioteer, mounting the box and inducing an old grey horse to indulge in some imperfect reminiscences of a canter. "Look at him, sir. Temper of a lamb and haction of a steam engine." resisting even the temptation of securing the services of so valuable a quadruped as the last named, Mr. Joseph Tuggs beckoned to the proprietor of a dingy conveyance of a greenish hue, lined with faded striped calico, and the luggage and the family having been deposited therein, the animal in the shafts, after describing circles in the road for a quarter of an hour, at last consented to depart in quest of lodgings. "How many beds have you got?" screamed Mrs. Tuggs out of the fly to the woman who opened the door of the first house, which displayed a bill intimating that apartments were to be let within. "How many did you want, ma'am?" was, of course, the reply. "Three. Will you step in, ma'am?" Down got Mrs. Tuggs. The family were delighted. Splendid view of the sea from the front windows. Charming. A short pause. Back came Mrs. Tuggs again. "One parlour and a mattress." "Why the devil did they say so at first?" inquired Mr. Joseph Tuggs rather pettishly. "Don't know," said Mrs. Tuggs. "Wretches," exclaimed the nervous Simon. Another bill, another stoppage. Same question, same answer, similar result. "What do they mean by this?" inquired Mr. Joseph Tuggs, thoroughly out of temper. "Don't know," said the placid Mrs. Tuggs. "Always the way here, sir," said the driver, by way of accounting for the circumstance in a satisfactory manner, and off they went again to make fresh inquiries and encounter fresh disappointments. It had grown dusk when the fly, the rate of whose progress greatly belied its name, after climbing up four or five perpendicular hills, stopped before the door of a dusty house with a bay window from which you could obtain a beautiful glimpse of the sea, if you thrust half of your body out of it at the imminent peril of falling into the area. Mrs. Tuggs alighted. One ground-floor sitting-room and three cells with beds in them upstairs. A double house, family on the opposite side. Five children, milk and watering in the parlour, and one little boy expelled for bad behaviour, screaming on his back in the passage. "What's the terms?" said Mrs. Tuggs. The mistress of the house was considering the expediency of putting on an extra guinea, so she coughed slightly and affected not to hear the question. "What's the terms?" said Mrs. Tuggs, in a louder key.
5 guineas a week, ma'am, with attendance," replied the lodging-house keeper.
"Attendance means the privilege of ringing the bell as often as you like, for your own amusement."
"Rather dear," said Mrs. Tuggs. "Oh, dear, no, ma'am," replied the mistress of the house, with a benign smile of pity at the ignorance of manners and customs which the observation betrayed. "Very cheap."
Such an authority was indisputable. The Pawnbroker's Shop.
"What have you got here?" inquires the shopman, unpinning the bundle.
"Old concern, I suppose. Pair of stays and a petticoat. You must look up something else, old woman. I can't lend you anything more upon them. They're completely worn out by this time, if it's only by putting in and taking out again 3 times a week.
"Oh, you're a rum un, you are," replies the old woman, laughing extremely, as in duty bound. "I wish I'd got the gift of the gab like you. See if I'd be up the spout so often then. No, no, it ain't the petticoat. It's a child's frock and a beautiful silk handkercher as belongs to me husband. He gave 4 shillin' for it the very same blessed day as he broke his arm."
"What do you want upon these?" inquires Mr. Henry, slightly glancing at the articles, which in all probability are old acquaintances. "What do you want upon these?"
18 pence.
"Lend you 9 pence.
"Oh, make it 1 shilling, there's a dear. Do now."
"Not another farthing."
"Well, I suppose I must take it."
The duplicate is made out, one ticket pinned on the parcel, the other given to the old woman. The parcel is flung carelessly down into a corner, and some other customer prefers his claim to be served without further delay. The choice falls on an unshaven, dirty, sottish-looking fellow, whose tarnished paper cap, stuck negligently over one eye, communicates an additionally repulsive expression to his very uninviting countenance. He was enjoying a little relaxation from his sedentary pursuits a quarter of an hour ago in kicking his wife up the court. He has come to redeem some tools, probably to complete a job with, on account of which he has already received some money, if his inflamed countenance and drunken staggers may be taken as evidence of the fact. Having waited some little time, he makes his presence known by venting his ill-humour on a ragged urchin, who, being unable to bring his face on a level with the counter by any other process, has employed himself in climbing up and then hooking himself on with his elbows, an uneasy perch from which he has fallen at intervals, generally alighting on the toes of the person in his immediate vicinity. In the present case, the unfortunate little wretch has received a cuff which sends him reeling to the door, and the donor of the blow is immediately the object of general indignation. "What do you strike the boy for, you brute?" exclaims a slipshod woman with two flat irons in a little basket. "Do you think he's your wife, you willin?" "Go and hang yourself," replies the gentleman addressed with a drunken look of savage stupidity, aiming at the same time a blow at the woman, which fortunately misses its object. "Go and hang yourself, and wait till I come and cut you down." "Cut you down?" rejoins the woman. "I wish I had the cutting of you up, you wagabond." Loud. "Oh, you precious wagabond." Rather louder. "Where's your wife, you willin?" Louder still. Women of this class are always sympathetic, and work themselves into a tremendous passion on the shortest notice. "Your poor dear wife, as you use, is worse than her a dog. Strike a woman, you a man." Very shrill. "Wish I had you, I'd murder you, I would, if I died for it." "Now be civil," retorts the man fiercely. "Be civil, you wiper," ejaculates the woman contemptuously. "Ain't it shocking?" she continues, turning round and appealing to an old woman who is peeping out of one of the little closets we have before described, and who has not the slightest objection to join in the attack, possessing, as she does, the comfortable conviction that she has bolted in. "Ain't it shocking, ma'am?" "Dreadful," says the old woman in a parenthesis, not exactly knowing what the question refers to. "He's got a wife, ma'am, as takes in mangling, and is as industrious and hard-working a young woman as can be." Very fast. "As lives in the back parlour of our house, which my husband and me lives in the front one." With great rapidity. "And we hears him a-beating on her sometimes when he comes home drunk the whole night through, and not only a-beating her, but beating his own child too, to make her more miserable. Oh, you beast! And she, poor creature, won't swear the peace agin him, nor do nothing, because she likes the wretch arter all. Worse luck!" Here, as the woman has completely run herself out of breath, the pawnbroker himself, who has just appeared behind the counter in a grey dressing-gown, embraces the favourable opportunity of putting in a word. "Now, I won't have none of this sort of thing on my premises," he interposes with an air of authority. "Mrs. Mackin, keep yourself to yourself, or you don't get fourpence for a flat iron here. And Jinkins, you leave your ticket here till you're sober, and send your wife for them two planes, for I won't have you in my shop at no price, so make yourself scarce before I make you scarcer."
These extracts have been taken from the recording of Selections from Sketches by Boz, read by David Timpson for Naxos Audiobooks.